From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
The courts ordered the NSA out of your phone records. Hillary Clinton got aggressive on immigration, and New Yorkers learned the dark side of fabulous nails. Hello and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at the New York Times. On the left, Robert Scheer, author of the new book about the American surveillance state They Know Everything About You, is at our KCRW mothership in Santa Monica. Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, is on the right in Washington. And here with me is special guest Joan Walsh, editor-at-large of Salon.com. Welcome to all of you. So on Thursday, a federal appeals court ruled the NSA's program of bulk collection of phone records is illegal, that it is not authorized under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. That provision of the law is set to expire in a few weeks anyway, and Congress has been hotly debating how much to narrow the scope of the NSA's snooping. Reforms to narrow surveillance have been gaining bipartisan support, but are strongly resisted by Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Bob, I know you've been following this closely. How happy are you about this court ruling?
Well, first of all, it establishes that I'm the center on this show, and the rest of you represent fringe positions. I'm thrilled that not just that the court took this position, which was it did not. I thought they would invoke the Fourth Amendment, but they didn't have to yet. What they said was this was a misreading of the Patriot Act, and that's an important point because there's been a secret reading of the Patriot Act. And as Congressman Sensenbrenner, who wrote it, a Republican congressman who was head of the Judiciary Committee at that time, has pointed out, they misinterpreted his legislation and what Congress had passed, and that it did not give them the authority to grab everybody's metadata, phone data, and so forth, and all the other things. Well, the court, in a 92-page decision, went right through that and said, no, they violated the law as written. That puts Edward Snowden in a very interesting position, because now no one can deny he's a whistleblower. Here a unanimous appeals court has said, you know, it was the NSA and the executive branch that violated the law. So therefore, Snowden, who informed us about this as a New York Times editorial just today as we go to air, did credit Snowden with bringing this issue to the fore. He revealed basically what is a crime. And then the question is, why isn't he pardoned or freed of any possible charges? The other point I want to make is a bipartisan point. I'm always terrorized by friends, my more liberal friends, that of the lesser evil and how terrible the Republicans are. But the fact is, a bipartisan 25-2 vote in the House Judiciary Committee said, no, the Patriot Act has to be radically reformed to put in privacy protection. They wouldn't go along with Mitch McConnell's idea in the Senate that you would just pass it and as opposed to letting it sunset. And I think that's a breakthrough that the Judiciary Committee has said, no, this is improper. And the reason that it has a very good chance in the Senate, again, going to this lesser evil argument, four members of the House, four Republicans, I'm always supposed to feel terrible when Republicans win, but four of them are now senators, and they've joined people like Rand Paul in saying, no, we don't. We want to change this act in a very serious way. So I'm feeling very optimistic at the moment.
Rich, what do you make of that? Does this make you reevaluate Edward Snowden at all in the value of his disclosures?
No, I think this. I don't think a lot of this decision. It was by a very liberal panel, and the fact is, the history of that. The panel concluded that this metadata program, all of it, isn't relevant, and that under 215, it says the records have to be relevant to an investigation. The reason why you had that weaselly word relevant in there is because you had the national security right at the time, early in the Bush administration, saying that the president had the authority to do this on his this kind of intelligence work on his own, and there didn't need to be any legal review. And you had the left saying, well, we at least want a fig leaf of legal review, and the compromise was relevant. Now, obviously, politically, we've moved way beyond that point, and I would support making the legislation more explicit. So if you're a layman actually reading it, you would have some idea what's actually being authorized here. And I think the most likely outcome in the near term in Congress is that they just a temporary reauthorization, because the House is in a very different place than the Senate is likely to be, and the Senate is divided up all over the place. So I think the ideal result would be actually explicitly authorizing it more clearly, but we'll see where it lands.
It's remarkable to me, Joan, how the politics on this seem to have moved in the last few years. There's a lot more resistance to the sort of broad surveillance authority that Congress at least seems to have thought it was giving in the Patriot Act a few years ago. Do you think that's a steady shift, or is this a thing where the country just changes its mood based on, you know, how at risk they feel, and the next terrorist attack that comes around, it could just shift that right back?
I think it's a steady shift. I think that people have learned more about what they're keeping, and I do give credit to Edward Snowden on this with Bob. But, you know, the Senate is going to be tougher than the House. You still do have this, you know, you have McConnell. John McCain just said today that we're forgetting about 9/11. And, you know, he would certainly make the point that if another terror attack would you know, get people to authorize this. But I think it's going to be very interesting. I think you've got, you know, not just Rand Paul, but you've got, you know, when you have Pat Leahy and Mike Lee coming together on the Freedom Act.
That's a very liberal Democrat from Vermont and a very conservative one from Utah.
Right. Yeah. Something really different is going on.
Bob, I want to ask you to handicap this a little bit. Are you, you know, Rich is saying we're going to get a temporary authorization. Do you think you're going to win out on this?
Well, it's not just my position. I think it's what the framers had in mind with the Fourth Amendment. I think even the Roberts Court, which said the police can't just crack into your cell phones and use that information, that it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And the point that Roberts made in that decision last June was there's more information on that phone than was ever in your house. And the framers intended, he said, the American Revolution was fought over the principle that's in the Fourth Amendment. And that this goes back to English common law, goes back to the Magna Carta. We need private space to be free. That's the basic point. And I think the more we learn about it, but I do want to address one thing. You say the next terror attack. Well, we've had these terror attacks. There's no evidence, not one single case that anybody's been able to come up with where, in fact, this made us safer. You're grabbing this great haystack of information, and what you still fail to do is connect the dots. And this came up even most recently in Texas. That today, again, as we go to air, the FBI said, oh, we warned these people all along. We've had this person talking to informants. We've had them on the observation. This was true of Charlie Hebdo in Paris. It was true in the Boston Marathon. These people were known. All you needed to do was old-fashioned police work. You didn't need to find everyone's underwear size in the country to go after terrorism. It's just nonsense.
Well, let us know what you think about the NSA court ruling at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, Hillary moves to the left on immigration. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief of TruthDig.com. Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, is on the right. And Joan Walsh, editor-at-large at Salon.com, is our special guest. Hillary Clinton made news this week with some very aggressive remarks on immigration. It was unsurprising that she said she was for comprehensive immigration reform and a path to citizenship. It was more surprising that she pledged to go farther than President Obama has already gone to use executive power on immigration, and she suggested the federal government is currently deporting too many people. Joan, this is a remarkable move to me in that Hillary isn't vulnerable in the primary. She doesn't need to move to the left. She seems to have made a calculated choice that moving to the left on this issue is a good move for her in the general. She wants to pick this fight.
She's already looking at the general for sure, Josh. And, you know, I also went back and looked at her first big stumble in the 2008 race came in 2007 when on that famous debate stage with Tim Russert, the late Tim Russert, she flubbed her answer. She took 3 minutes to give a non-answer on the question of driver's licenses. And everybody suspected that she'd basically supported it, but she
couldn't. This was driver's licenses
for undocumented people, exactly. And Elliot Spitzer at the time was trying to push that in New York, and she had waffled in every different direction on whether it was a good idea. Seemed totally unprepared for the question and flubbed it. You know, fast forward all these years later, at almost 8 years later, I think politics have changed enormously. It's clear to her that there's not going to be comprehensive immigration reform anytime soon, despite the bipartisan efforts of last year. And it's also clear to her, I think, politically, I don't think she's doing something she doesn't believe in, but I also think it's clear to her that she's not reassembling the Bill Clinton coalition, you know, heavy on working class whites, heavy on a cultural appeal to those working class whites. She's trying to consolidate and expand the Obama coalition. And she has a chance, I think, to make Latinos Democrats for at least a generation with this.
You know, Rich, you know, one of the things that's remarkable to me about this issue is that views on what powers the president holds with regard to immigration seem to line up almost exactly with views on what desirable immigration policy is. People who think that we should allow more immigration think that the executive has broad power to deal with it, and people who think we should have tight enforcement think the executive should have narrow power. It actually runs the opposite direction of the views on executive power in a lot of other areas like foreign policy. What do you make of that? Does anybody care, like, in principle, about rule of law and immigration?
Yes. I don't think that, unfortunately, I don't think the public cares as much as it should. But you look at the legal justification, even from the Obama administration, for their executive amnesty, and it's supposed to be on a case-by-case basis. I mean, that's the only rationale for prosecutorial discretion, the way it's supposed to work. This isn't a case-by-case program. This is waving through a huge swath of people and creating a new legal dispensation to authorize them to work. So you're creating a new program, and that's against the law. You can't do it. And President Obama was quite explicit repeatedly that he couldn't do that until he changed his mind. And what's one of the things that's most extraordinary about Hillary's position is we all thought that President Obama was pushing, you know, the very outer limits of the envelope, even by President Obama's own terms in the last several years, and now Hillary is saying she's going to go further. And I basically agree with Joan's political analysis of it, and I would just add one more point. I think it's a reaction to the fact that Republicans haven't been able to successfully push back in any way against the president's executive action. So what's the downside? You play to this a constituency of voters that's very important to your coalition, and the Republicans have so far proven themselves impotent to fight back.
Bob, one of the themes that seems to come up regularly on this show is that you don't feel Hillary is representing the left enough. Is this a development that makes you feel better about her?
Well, I don't want to repeat what I said before about surveillance, but I don't think immigration is necessarily a left-right issue. I do think it's a human rights issue. You've got a very significant number of people in this country, 12, 13, 14 million, no one knows, and who are hardworking and are here, many of them brought as children, no choice of their own. They're intermarried and extended families. And the question is, are you going to rip these people out of the society and deport them? And, it's human rights, and it's not left-right. And there are plenty of Republicans who have favored that in the past. I don't know what happened. It used to be the Democratic Party was the party, wanted to protect labor unions, was worried about wage rates, and it was the Republicans who had a more reasonable, moderate position on immigration. And even Pete Wilson in California, before he got all involved with Prop 187, they had a very good program of enforcing the labor laws, not the immigration law, and make sure people are being paid according to our law. Robert Reich and the Clinton administration supported when he was labor secretary. Make sure people are being paid for overtime. Make sure there are two bathrooms. Occupation health safety is being enforced and so forth. So I think this is an issue whether you have a labor force that is needed in the society, that is rooted in the society, and are you going to do the right thing by giving people a pass to legality and ultimately citizenship. That is going to be a mass position, like a lot of these controversial things. In California, it has already happened. And what Hillary is doing is what Jerry Brown has shown you have to do, which is embrace progress.
So, Joan, a lot of people, including the president, talk about this as an issue where basically Congress has failed to act and therefore he's had to act. But isn't it Congress's prerogative to not relax immigration laws and not authorize more immigrants in the United States?
Well, sure, it is. But I also think it's Congress's responsibility to look at the situation as it is and say, are you going to put out the money for mass deportation, solve this problem, solve the lawlessness, solve the fact that this has festered for all these years, or are you going to liberalize the laws or make do for people who are here and then tighten enforcement of the borders, tighten the borders? they, you know, we've done the enforcement piece, we've done the tightening piece, we've done the forces at the border piece. What we haven't done is the pathway to citizenship piece. It was a bipartisan bill. It took 13 years. It wasn't, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 or even 10 years. It was the product of an enormous compromise between, you know, advocates. I don't want to say on the left, Bob's right, but on the in the human rights community and people who are more concerned about border enforcement. It produced a bill that various people on both sides had problems with, but that had a lot of support, and the House dropped the ball. And we all know that I think any day, at least in the last Congress, John Boehner could have taken that bill up and passed it with Nancy Pelosi's help.
Well, let us know what you think about Hillary's move on immigration at kcrw.com/LRC. Finally, I want to do something a little different and talk about manicures. Specifically, I want to talk about Sarah Maslin's New York Times story on labor abuses in nail salons in the New York area. This piece has been widely read, and I think it has some interesting national policy implications. Now, if you don't live in New York, you might not realize nail salons have absolutely exploded here over the last 15 years. In fact, they're far more ubiquitous in the city than Starbucks locations are, and there are a lot of Starbucks in New York. Manicures are also one of the few things that are cheaper in New York than in most places. The Times found the average price of a manicure in New York was just $10.50, about half the national average. And now we have some understanding of why. The Times found most nail salon workers are making less than minimum wage. They work long hours but don't get overtime. They're routinely made to start as unpaid apprentices for weeks and months, and sometimes they even have to pay a fee to get a job. Now, New York's nail care industry relies heavily on immigrant workers, many of them unauthorized. And those workers have been reluctant to take their cases to the state's labor department, which is part of why these abuses have been able to fester. Jonah, I've seen so many people talking about this story. I know you've been covering it at Salon. What do you make of it?
I think it's a tragic story, and I think, you know, it's easy. There's been a lot of commentary on, you know, the women who go to these salons. I mean, the $10.50 manicure is serving, you know, working class and poor women, so it's people who can't afford to pay more. Maybe they wouldn't get their nails done. But it's really fun to focus on the women who are getting these manicures, and it's less fun, but it's super necessary for us to focus on the laws that are not being enforced. And it's a perfect segue from our last conversation. Number one, it's the lack of enforcement of immigration law, and it's a lack of rights for these people who happen to be here illegally. It's a complete crumbling of our enforcement of labor law. I mean, you know, the Times had great numbers about there are roughly 3,600 salons in New York State, and the state investigates maybe two to three dozen. And mainly, I mean, the New York Times itself got some action even before the story ran. But this is not an industry that's being paid attention to, and it reminds me so much of the women's garment industry, you know, in the early part of the 20th century that did lead to progressive reform, that led to the strengthening of labor laws, that led to the enforcement of labor laws. I hope, you know, I'm probably being optimistic, but I hope that this starts that conversation.
You know, Rich, Joan mentions the lack of supervision here, and I think part of that is because these are all really small businesses.
Right.
And politicians on both sides of the aisle really like to fetishize small business. But one advantage of large business is that somebody like McDonald's knows people are watching, and they can only get away with so much labor-wise. Is this a reason to maybe not prefer small business so much?
Well, I think as a general matter, small business is a good thing, but you point out a downside here. And this New York Times report was really in the best tradition of muckraking journalism from the early 20th century. And I think Joan is right, but it might extend her point in a way that she wouldn't agree with. We've created basically lawless areas, or sort of a culture of lawlessness around immigration, because the fact is the Obama administration, despite the rhetoric, has really gutted interior enforcement of immigration laws. There's almost zero chance that if you're a legal immigrant who is within the country, that you're going to get deported. And Jeb Bush and others love to tell this, you know, wonderful kind of gauzy story about how wonderful all forms of immigration are for this country. But here you see the downside of it, and you see why so many business interests are so in favor of open border policies. And it's the answer to why is very simple: cheap, easily exploited labor. If you're an illegal immigrant in this country, some of these brave people, they talked to the New York Times, obviously, some of them filed complaints, but most of them didn't because they were scared. And there's not a huge demand for their labor in our economy. And again, Jeb Bush will say, oh, you know, immigration increases economic growth. Well, perhaps the main way it increases economic growth is by creating cheaper services. And yes, that's a benefit to the economy. It's a great benefit to upper middle class people, but there's an ugly side to it, and we see it in this story.
But Rich, as we see in this story, the businesses have access to cheap, easily exploitable, unauthorized immigrant labor now. If you legalized these people, then they would at least, you know, they would be able to go to the government without fear that they would be deported. So it seems to me like that might actually be disadvantageous toward the businesses and advantageous toward labor. Yes, you would have people coming into the labor market here, and that might bid down wages, although some of the research contends that's not the case. Right. I find the research weird. It seems intuitively to me like it should be true that immigrants bid down wages, but at least that enforcement problem you described could be fixed in two ways. You could really aggressively enforce immigration laws, or you could legalize people so that they could take advantage of the laws.
Let me address that briefly because I know Bob wants to get in. Yes, I mean, you need to do both, and I think you need to sequence them the right way. You need an enforcement system that really works, and it's not just the border. Republicans love, you know, the great cliche about the border enforcement. It's important, but enforcing at the point of employment is arguably even more important with some sort of E-Verify system. And once you had this kind of system in place, including an exit entry visa system that really works, then you should amnesty some big portion of illegal immigrants who are here. Because if you do it before the enforcement's actually in place, and we've seen this before, then it's a magnet for the next wave of illegal immigrants. And that's what you want to avoid because, as we see in this story, it leads to really some tragic and ugly things we wouldn't want to have in our society.
Bob, you wanted to get in?
Yeah, I think Rich is on the right track here. I think amnesty is critical, and we can argue about when you do it. But I'll tell you, I covered this story for the LA Times for years, and when Pete Wilson, a Republican, was governor, and before he abandoned this idea and went for the punitive 187 that destroyed the Republican Party in the state, but when they went in there and they were teams, including labor, and they said, we have laws in place. Whether you're a small business or a big business, you have to pay time and a half, you have to have bathrooms, you have to give people a lunch break. You know, you can't have child labor. It's very clear. And so anybody going to those nail salons, whether they're lawyers or anybody else, knows the law is being violated. Then the question is whether you're going to do something about it. And you're right. People are scared. The first thing you do, and what Pete Wilson, the Republican governor's people, did when they went in, they said, we are not from immigration. We are from the Labor Department, and we're going to enforce the law. And when you do that, you find out whether the jobs exist, and you advance the human rights of the people who are being exploited. It is not a question of making them more frightened by having more cops go after them.
So, Joan, one of the things that I think that strikes people about the story is it's a really direct manifestation of inequality. It's somebody who's sitting right there, touching your hand, doing things to your nails. And some of the customers at these salons are of lower and middle incomes, but some of them are also more affluent.
Sure.
But I was thinking about it this morning, and it's like, you know, this is terrible. But then you think about, you know, the person who made the clothing you're wearing maybe got paid even less than the people providing these manicures.
Or the person who made your iPhone or, you know...
So why
Chinese
is this,
laborers.
Why is that morally different? If you can have, you know, labor and you know, I'm pro-trade. I think that, you know, people working in factories in China making low wages are better off than they would be working in agriculture in China making even lower wages. But it's this weird moral disconnect where it's like we have more obligation to the person who's here in Queens than to the person who's making something for us far away.
Well, you know, I think a lot of progressives would say we have an obligation globally. How we enforce that obligation is a whole different question, and that is at issue in the trade controversy that we're living through right now. But I think it makes sense that these people are in our country. They are touching our hands. The idea that, yes, we've all thought about, you know, the labor, we know about conditions at some of the Apple subcontractors, and we care about that. But the idea that people are living in the back of the salon where you're getting your nails done and that they're having miscarriages. I mean, the second part of the story today is more harrowing and horrifying than the first part yesterday where, you know, and again, it goes back to early labor law and even some of the things that we covered in the emerging technology industry in Silicon Valley in the 70s and 80s that, you know, we don't know enough about these chemicals. And then people come in and they enforce the law and they tell people about their rights. And, you know, the chemical reactions that people are having and, you know, it's heartbreaking and no one cares, but they are right there living among us. It really should shock us.
On the chemicals point, there was an interesting thing actually in Vox today about a program in the Bay Area. It's a voluntary program for salons where they get a certification basically reflecting that they abide by practices that prevent harmful chemical exposures and provide a healthy workplace. And one of the questions in the Vox story was, could this be applied also to the labor side? Could you have, you know, consumer action here that would basically push at least some fraction of the salons toward better labor practices? I don't know, Rich, do you like, aside from immigration enforcement, what do you see as the proper mix here between government regulatory action and consumer action to deal with these sorts of problems?
Well, I would say we should enforce the laws that are on the books before we pass any more, and we're not enforcing them. And yes, consumer pressure has a huge effect, and a much less heartbreaking example. You know, we've seen in the food, retail food industry, places like Panera Bread and Chipotle saying we're not going to use certain ingredients as a play for broader market share and to their consumers. So what you'd want to see here, I think, is every guy and gal who is thinking about getting a pedicure or manicure is now going to think twice about what salon they go to. And there should be some effort on the part of these salons, you know, the better ones, to advertise that they actually have better standards for chemicals and for their workers and for all around, and try to attract more customers on that basis.
Look.
Well, first, thanks to Rich for saying guys and gals, but it is, I will acknowledge it is mainly gals of the four of us. I'm the only one who periodically does this. But I also think, you know, here in New York, we all look for that A, that health department A, before we go into a restaurant. And if you see a B or a C or a grade penny, you're a little put off. You know, it's really an interesting thought that you know, these salons would say, you know, we pay our workers at least minimum wage. We, you know, we don't use these chemicals. And I did, you know, I just moved here from the Bay Area, and I did see some of those green salons that didn't use the awful chemicals, and they were better places to be as a consumer, because it's pretty disgusting, some of those.
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Bob, your soapbox.
My rant is informed by my brother-in-law, Peter, works in the post office at night and listens to a lot of radio, and he pointed out Hillary Clinton's contributors are all from Wall Street, the first list. Bernie Sanders are small pocket people giving an average of something like $40. That's an argument for considering Bernie Sanders over Hillary Clinton.
Rich Lowry, your rant this week.
There's a thwarted terror attack in Garland, Texas, over a Draw Muhammad contest. And incredibly enough, some on the left are actually blaming the prospective victim here, Pamela Geller, for holding the contest and effectively saying she should shut up and acknowledge what would be an assassin's veto in this area, where we'd live in a country where literally nothing is sacred except for the image of Muhammad, which would be perverse.
Joan Walsh, what's on your mind?
All the conversation about immigration has just made me realize that we will look back at that failed Senate bill and that failed opportunity and John Boehner's failure to bring it up and say it was an incredible political scandal in this country.
For my rant, Carly Fiorina announced her campaign for president this week, and like a lot of business leaders before her, she made the case that her success in business is a reason that she would be successful in government. The weird thing about Fiorina, though, is that she was arguably not that successful in business. She was the CEO of Hewlett-Packard for 6 years, after which she was fired. Her main initiative as Hewlett-Packard CEO was to buy Compaq, a struggling computer company in an industry where almost nobody was making any profits. HP continued to make almost no profits in computers, and that's why the board gave her the axe. We can talk about whether experience in business transfers to experience in government, but it seems to me like if you're going to run on your experience in business, you should at least have done really well in business. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Rich Lowry, and Joan Walsh. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Our production assistant is Sarah Singer Schiff. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.